Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of April. Our guest this hour, Andrew Ferguson, senior editor at the Weekly Standard and author of Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course on Getting His Kid into College. It is amazing what people will do to get their children into college, and Andrew's not at the, on the deep end of this. There are people who are planning this whole process since the day their children are born, if you can believe that. And he talks about some of those people. It's a very serious look at the schools that, you know, the game that they play to attract students. It looks at the schools that are very hard to get into and super kids who are trying to get into those schools. The essay that young people write, is it the junior year in high school that's all important, or is it more than that? What about U.S. News and World Report, which ranks all of the colleges? What about all of the books? And I'm guilty. I've looked at these books, too. You know, what are the 100 most interesting liberal arts schools that you can afford in the Midwestern part of the United States? What about legacy admissions? What about well, they're expensive going to college. The purpose of the SATs, and he took the SAT, although he will not tell us. Maybe we'll get him to what the score on math was. I don't know if we can get him to divulge that or not. Andrew is formerly a senior writer for the Washingtonian magazine. He is the author of Fools, Names, Fools, Faces, a collection of essays, and Land of Lincoln, named by the Wall Street Journal and the Chicago Tribune as a favorite book of the year. He is currently a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. Did I say that? And he's written for The New Yorker, The New York Magazine, The New Republic, American Spectator, LA Times, New York Times, Washington Post, and many other publications. In 1992, he was a White House speechwriter for President George Herbert Walker Bush, and he is our guest. His son, by the way, did make it into college. And I believe he has a daughter who is on her way pretty soon, if not this year. They're looking, it's next year. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for being on the air with us. Is your daughter about ready to go to college?
Yes, we're sort of at that heartbreaking time when she's finally settled on a place to go, and then it's just a matter of counting down the days.
So she's been accepted?
Yes, she got in. You know, she didn't get into, I think, her top choices, but she got into a school that I think she should be very happy to go to, which is College of Charleston down in South Carolina.
Yeah, great.
Which will be a nice place for me to visit.
Yeah. And my son just, we have three boys and two have been out of the house for a while, but my son just left for college this year, and I still don't know what to do with myself. You know, I just miss him so much, Andrew. I know it's not the focus of the book, but please write a book about that, because I think it's very hard for parents, and you write about this. It's not like they ever really come home again.
Right, right. That was one of the things, you know, I had to deal with at the end of the book, because the book's partly a chronicle of our personal journey trying to help our son get into school, but that, you know, that's the last stage, and it's sort of a paradox, I guess, but it's all of parenthood in concentrated form, this whole process, because what you're really doing is preparing the people you can't live without to live without you, and you're making happen something that, you know, deep down I think a lot of parents hate to see happen, which is to bid goodbye to the years of raising children and your beautiful little sons and daughters, and it all gets mixed up in this competitive atmosphere and the the extreme amounts of energy and money that are expended. But right at the bottom of it is this love that we have for our kids.
Right. I offered to homeschool at college age, but that didn't go over. And nobody wanted that. I was amazed by your statistics early on. 70% of our young people do go to college, and 80% are looking at schools that don't involve a whole lot of difficulties, a lot of maneuvering to get your child in.
Right. 70% of high school seniors go on to college, not that many continue into college. There's quite a drastic attrition rate after that. But the fact of it is, you know, there's an awful lot of press, and there's an entire industry that, and of course now my book Crazy You is part of it. I guess I could say that kind of churns up this idea that everyone is caught up in the competition. And it's really not so. It's a phenomenon of, I suppose, the middle class or the upper middle class, however you'd say it. One of the first things I did when I was starting the book, my son was still 16 or 17, I guess going on 17. A friend had told me about a woman in New York, a private college counselor who charged $40,000 to help your kid get into one of the top three schools of his or her choice. And I was just kind of staggered by this
thought.
That is
staggering.
I went up with her to a seminar that she gave outside New York at a kind of fancy banking center that they have there. And most of the parents obviously were the kind of people who might consider spending $40,000, which, of course, is not something that I could do. But then as I went along in my research, I discovered that this phenomenon was not a phenomenon of just rich people. This was something that had really gone deep into the income strata, or however you'd put it. People of all income levels really were starting to get gripped by this college fever.
The thing that knocked me out is when I think you were having breakfast with her and you thought she was going through the same thing, waiting for, you know, the letter that was going to come, or and she was all stressed out, and it was for nursery school. It was for her 9-month-old kid.
Pre-K, yeah. She said, "Oh, you know, we were walking to breakfast, and she said, you know, I'm, you know, kind of in a similar situation here. You know, we've got an essay to write, and then there's the interview coming up, and you know, then all the tests." And I said, "Well, so now you see what it's like to apply to college." And she said, "Yeah, except this is for pre-K."
Can you believe it?
And sure enough, there was somebody who was going to come to their house who was going to interview them. They had to write a little essay about their children. The little kid was going to be tested with blocks and that sort of thing. And so this was, as she told me, very important, because she had to get her kid into the right pre-K, because that was a feeder into the right kinds of kindergartens, which would get you into the right grade schools. And then, of course, at the end of the rainbow was the pot of gold of, you know, Harvard or Yale or Brown or something.
Don't you feel so sorry for that child?
I do. You know, I wonder. I mean, she's really quite a wonderful person, but yeah, she's like a lot of us, I think. She feels like she's got trapped in something that you don't really see a way out of. And there were lots of moments, as I describe in the book, that where you kind of, you know, thump your head and say, "What am I doing? This is crazy." And then, you know, the next day comes and you find yourself doing something else. You know, you're going online to find out more advice, or you're going to buy a new book, or you're going to help your kid do this or that. Right. It's kind of a struggle between the heart and the head. Your head knows that this is crazy, but the heart keeps tugging you back into it.
Well, you make some really interesting points about your son. I mean, your son is a 16-year-old person, and people are writing essays and demanding that you develop yourself as this individual human being who has this very deep take on the world and his or her future at an age where, I'm sorry, you look at your kids and most kids I know just aren't there. They're just not huge, deep thinkers, nor they should they be, I think, required to be at that age.
Yeah, I was really struck by this. The essay process, you know, when people say the applications are, are difficult. What they're really talking about are the application essays. The applications themselves are pretty much just, as you know, straightforward questionnaires, and you fill in the blanks. But the essays are heavily weighted towards the kind of introspective, self-absorbed questions and or prompts, as they're called now, that are meant to elicit, I don't know whether it's sort of an emotional catharsis or some kind of deep self-revelation on the part of the kid. This college counselor that we were talking about, when my son had terrible difficulties with the questions that he was trying to answer. There were things like, tell us about a moment when you refused to be embarrassed, or things like this. And she said, well, just tell him that he has to dig deep in himself. He has to tell us his innermost thoughts. And I said, lady, he is a 17-year-old boy. He doesn't have any innermost thoughts. And if he did, neither you nor I would want to know what they are.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. We wouldn't want to know it. And then you look at the process of admissions, and that 5 minutes maybe is spent on some of these applications, and what it is that there is advice that you give, but you have to have a certain kind. You can't do my exotic foreign vacation. You got to have a combination of, you know, I saved a school in El Salvador, and
right.
And I did these remarkable things, that you have to have this profile that, I'm sorry, how many kids have this? And should they be required to have that for top-notch schools at that age?
Yeah. Well, I started to see this, what I called the professionalization of childhood, and I saw it particularly when I went to this seminar with the very pricey college counselor, the $40,000 lady. But you know, there were parents there who had been preparing for this moment since they were sixth and seventh grade. You know, they actually talk about putting together what they call a brag sheet, which I find a particularly repulsive term, but also they call it a resume, which is, you know, you kind of start putting together a portfolio of the best essays that your kid has written since fifth grade, tapes of musical performances or athletic performances, letters of, you know, commendation they might have gotten. And again, this isn't just a phenomenon of wealthy people now. This has become something that the right. middle class is deeply embedded in, and it's almost as though we're telling kids that the first real act that you're to engage in the adult world, as you go into the adult world, is an act of marketing, and you're the product, and you have to sell yourself. And that's a relatively recent notion, I think, and it's not particularly an appealing one.
Yeah, you spent some time early in the book talking about your own college experience and how you decided you wanted to go to where it was warm, and you had this liberal arts kind of background. And I went to college not knowing what I wanted to do either, and it was fairly easy for me to get into a pretty good school, and you know, I tried a lot of different college courses that maybe wouldn't have translated into making money in the real world. But it was a whole different experience, and in many ways, I don't know if it's just nostalgia, but we were able to take in a lot of ideas then. Can you do that now? Can your son and daughter do that now?
Well, you know, I noticed one of the things I talk about in the book is that I must have had 1,000 conversations with parents and others about how to get your kid into college. I had next to none about what they were supposed to do once they got there. If anything, the process, it's almost the opposite. Once you, it's a very strict kind of regimented process to apply to college. Once you're there, all the restraints seem to fall away.
It's been, right.
When I went to school back in the 70s, there were still such things as core curriculums and requirements and so on. Now those seem to have faded away, and there's a lot of sort of make your own major, do your own course of study and create courses for yourself and all this sort of thing. So if anything, there's almost too many ideas floating around. And many more than there were when we were in school.
Mm-hmm. And I still can't get over, which shows my age, you've got men and women on the same floor in the dormitory.
Yes, right.
Isn't that something?
Yes. Well, and it's, you know, and you're the bigger confusion and the thing that kind of got to me and I tried to figure out in the book is, what do we think this is for? What is college supposed to be? You know, the ideal, I guess, of college that most of these institutions were founded on was sort of a four-year program, kind of a nurturing of the spirit where the young people were familiarized with all the best that had been thought and said in the world, and you learn the sort of the foundations of our civilization and learn to think critically about it and so on. On the other hand, being Americans, we want it to pay. We want this to have some payoff in terms of a good job at the end. So is it supposed to be job training, or is it supposed to be, you know, this nurturing of the spirit? And what's happened is that we've ended up with something that's neither one or the other. I talk in the book about my own experience, as you mentioned, and just a quick anecdote about that is when I was ending my 4 years of liberal arts study, this was in 1978 and 9, and the economy was even almost as bad as it is now, and job prospects were pretty dim. And I finally went up to our placement counselor in the school and took a battery of tests that might show what kind of job I could get. And she graded the tests and called me in, and she said, "Now, you understand, don't you, that you have no marketable skills whatsoever?" Which is sort of a haunting thing to hear when you're...
Right.
So, of course, I became a journalist. What else was I going to do?
Right. I did the same thing. But we were lucky in some ways, weren't we? When you think about it, we were just lucky.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a country where luck happens pretty often to people. And we're fortunate, in fact, that this is that the country is such that it can almost, I guess the word is, indulge in this kind of... this kind of craziness.
Right. We're going to take phone calls. Let's go to an email, though, first from Gina. What are your thoughts, Andrew, about the success rate of kids who figure out what they're passionate about before they head off to college?
Well, I think that a lot of them will be in for a surprise because, at least in my personal experience and in talking to a lot of college professors and administrators, as I did for the book, one of the huge constants, I would say, in the experience of college people is the degree to which kids change their interests as they go through the 4 years. So I think it's wonderful to be passionate about anything, but I suppose that what most of the professors and counselors that I talk to would say is stay flexible. Be passionate, but stay flexible because you may get hit over the head by something when you're a sophomore that had never even occurred to you before, and your passion will shift.
Andrew Ferguson is our guest this hour. His book is Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Starting our phone calls with George from Galesville. Hi, George.
Hey, hi. I just thought I'd call because I believe very strongly in education. I think there's two major reasons for getting a good education. One is to, you know, get a good job. And number two, or become a success, let's say. I'm talking money. And number two is for fully realizing a young person's potential. That means appreciate arts, appreciate life. And I think, you know, we have to keep those two things in mind. They're totally separate. You may go to a school and not end up with a great career, but you may be a fully developed human being after you leave. I also question the desire to go to a good school. I have a very close acquaintance with quite a number of good schools, Stanford, Northwestern, Carleton, and others. I also have a close relationship with University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. And I have a hard time really justifying why in the world a guy would pay the kind of money you have to pay to go to some of those former schools that I mentioned when you could go to University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. I mean, it's a great school. And lastly, I'm 70-some years old. I mean, I'm thinking about the successes I know in the world. Most of them were not in the top of their class, and most of them actually didn't go to some of the classy schools. Most of them have a great human, they're great at getting along with people. They probably got C's in college, but they are great at getting along with people. And these are the people, I think, who have a better chance of becoming a success, i.e. money. What do you think?
Oh, good points. Andrew.
Boy, a lot of very good points mm-hmm. there. Well, one point about your point about La Crosse, I think, is I have many friends who went there, actually, from high school, having gone to high school in outside Chicago. You know, it is a marvelous school, and there is no question but that someone could go to La Crosse or Northern Illinois or any number of state schools that are relatively inexpensive, and that's relatively, and get a better education than a kid going to Stanford. There's just no question about that. It is a matter of how motivated the kid is to search out and find the professors and the courses and the kind of stimulation that they're looking for, and that is as available in La Crosse as it is in Palo Alto. I'm also very interested in this idea about the people who do become successful in life, you know, at least in commercial terms, because I saw this same thing. You know, there's the old saying that A students end up working for B students, and B students work in companies owned by C students. And I think that there's something to that. And certainly, when I spent some time at Harvard, and I talk a little bit about it there, as you know, wonderful as Harvard is, and wonderful kids go there, and all that, you do see that the value that is really prized there is a kind of conformity, a way of learning how to please powerful people in authority. And that is not necessarily the character trait that helps you get ahead in life in the most creative and original ways. In fact, it's almost opposite of creativity and originality. So there's a lot there. You know, this is one of the things I loved about writing the book, is this is such a rich subject and takes in so many questions.
One thing that I found rather disturbing is you were sitting in a session and somebody asked the question, one of the parents, how many of your freshman students are legacy admissions? And they hemmed and hawed, and wound up giving a pretty darn high figure.
Yeah, in fact, that was at Harvard. We had one of the things you do when you go for a college tour at Harvard is they give you a you know, the usual propaganda show, and there was a big video in which the point of it was that anybody can go to Harvard. You really ought to apply.
Right.
And it was narrated by Tommy Lee Jones, who's just your average Hollywood actor who, when he went to Harvard, had roomed with Al Gore, who was vice president. And then when the lights came back up and it was over, and this whole thing, it kind of struck me as disingenuous. One of the parents said, "Tell us about legacies. How many kids do you admit whose parents went to school?" And she said, "Oh, we don't have that information." As you say, she just hemmed and hawed and finally gave the figure 30-35%.
Wow.
Which seemed to totally,
right,
totally negate what the whole point of this propaganda exercise had been.
Yeah. George, thank you so much for your call. Mark in Michigan is next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine. How are you, Mark?
Very well, thank you. Listening to the speaker today, and great content and such. I'm a parent of a son who's trying to get into one of the more prominent Big Ten schools, and he scored very well on his ACT, like 31, A-point average, or A average in high school. And the school went to the Common App this year, and they seem to be completely unprepared for the influx of applications that they got. And my son did the early app in November and then basically got deferred before Christmas. And then the deadline of mid-April got waitlisted now. And so we're kind of really between a rock and a hard place trying to scramble to our B choices. But my question is this, you know, Common App seems to kind of be watering down a lot of these fine institutions, and they just seem to be bogged down with too many applications.
That's absolutely true. What your experience has been repeated all over the country. The Common App, for those who don't know it, is an application that's available on the internet that an increasing number of schools, I think now almost 60% of four-year colleges in America will take the Common Application, and that relieves them of the burden of having to devise their own application, and it makes it easier on students to file the application and get access to it. The problem is that it's made it too easy, and schools are seeing schools with, you know, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 slots in their freshman class are seeing application numbers of 30,000, 32,000.
Goodness gracious.
And they have never experienced anything like this, and this has been accelerating over the last 5 or 6 years as the Common App has become more more popular. And it really has overwhelmed schools. And I'll tell you a dirty secret. I mean, there are a few dirty secrets that I found out about that were sort of discouraging. Schools don't necessarily dislike this, that the fact that they're being overwhelmed with applications, because the more applications they get, the lower their acceptance rate appears. And the lower their acceptance rate is, the higher their ranking will be in U.S. News and World Report
goodness.
Rankings and so on. And they'll look more selective, which draws a higher caliber, in quotes, kid, applicant, and so on. And they get in a virtuous cycle where they think that they just become more and more prestigious. So they have an incentive to get kids to apply to their school who they know don't have a chance. And it's really something kind of sinister, I have to say, about that in the admissions world, that they know, as at Harvard, they know that they're getting applications that they really are never going to be able to seriously consider, all as a way to make their own institution look better.
Yeah, that's sick, actually. It's hard for me to believe that Mark's son, who he said had an A average and a 31 ACT, can't pretty much write his own ticket.
Well, that's just another sign of the competitiveness that's going on. There's also, I'll give you another example that actually started when I was looking into the Harvard business. Another college counselor explained to me about admissions, something that I don't think I've seen anywhere else and is really sort of a trade secret. If you look at, say, a U.S. News and World Report or the view book or the brochures that come from the schools, they'll say, we have an application percent admission rate of 20%, and that means that one out of every five kids who applies gets in. Well, that's an extremely selective rate, 20%, but chances are it's actually closer to 10%, because what's going on with that other half of that 20% is there are legacies, as we saw with Harvard. There are athletic scholarships. There are people who are brought in for different kinds of reasons, whether for reasons of diversity or because they need, more tuba players in the band. They need people whose parents are wealthy who will give a lot of money to the school, development cases they call. And when you really add those up, it's often cuts that acceptance rate in half. And so when they tell you that it's 20%, chances are it's closer to 10.
Goodness. Thank you, Mark, very much for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Some lines are open right now, and our guest is Andrew Ferguson. He's the author of Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. Andrew is senior editor at the Weekly Standard and author of a number of other books as well. We go to another email, this one from Bonnie. I just took my daughter, who's a sophomore this year, to look at colleges. We're finding out kids are taking advanced placement classes to be further along in college. When we spoke with a professor, he told me that these classes aren't worth taking because every school does classes differently, and these classes are coming up short to where the education fits at the college level.
Unfortunately, this is another one of the secrets that I think is kind of starting to get out now. The AP classes, which are billed in high schools as advanced placement, as a way for kids to acquire college credit that they can then apply when they go off to college, are kind of a con job in a lot of cases, because more and more schools are taking a look at these AP classes and deciding that they aren't really being taught at a college level, and therefore the schools, the colleges, don't want to accept those credits. On the other hand, that's not a terrible thing, because one of the initial reasons behind the AP classes was the kids would arrive freshman year in a school having already established a number of college credits, and therefore they could go for 4 years, pay the full freight, and actually take up less time in the classroom. So the colleges themselves came out ahead the more AP kids that they brought in and the more AP credits they awarded. But as I say, right now there's a reversal in that.
Mike is next in Illinois. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you know, I'm listening to this conversation, and, you know, my daughter is actually going to get her master's degree right now. And but what I noticed through this whole process of her going to college and everything, that this has become a huge industry, that it's no longer just for the sake of education for the kids. It's more the fact that these colleges need to make money to exist. And, you know, you get a situation where she tried to get into a state school in Illinois, and it was an absolute nightmare. And it's a state school, but most of the students that are getting accepted there aren't from the state. You know, they exclude kids. They don't give any preference to somebody who's from the state, which gets funding from the state. And the cost was enormous for her to go there. And, you know, I see this all over. Matter of fact, it was less expensive for her to, she went for her freshman year to an out-of-state school, which cost her less than the in-state school. And it's a bit shocking. I mean, she's in debt up to her ears. Aww. And I have a bit of debt, too, that went along with this.
Yeah.
So it just seems to me that I'm not seeing. And secondly, yet another caller who called in was talking about success being how much money they're going to make after school. That is the consideration of success, which is another issue with these colleges. You know, it's how much money are you going to make as opposed to how educated are you going to be when you leave?
Andrew.
Yeah. Well, again, so many great points there. I'm afraid this experience is another one that's being repeated all over the country. And your basic insight, it's one of the themes of Crazy You, is that this has now become a huge industry. And except it's odd for a couple of reasons. One is it's a highly competitive industry that's run by people who refuse to believe it's competitive and don't think they're in an industry. But the fact is that for what we know about colleges now, which is that they're too expensive, there's not a lot of learning going on there, point to the idea that this is an industry that is, you know, if any other industry in America failed in its core missions the way higher education is and had as many dissatisfied customers as we're hearing on some of these calls, they would just collapse. And one of the questions I wanted to answer as I went through writing the book is, why doesn't it? Why doesn't it collapse? Why isn't there a kind of a bubble bursting here? And, of course, the answer is, I mean, I look in the mirror. It's because of, you know, parents like me who are willing to, you know, sacrifice and swallow their pride once in a while and to help their kids get ahead and lead happy and fulfilling lives.
Mm-hmm. What about his point concerning tuition? Are there a lot of state schools who are taking more out-of-state students to get more money?
Yeah, and this is set up at, you know, I don't know how you'd say that, the people are at loggerheads about this, because the people who are actually running the schools are trying to admit more out-of-state students, because the out-of-state students will pay often twice as much, or
right,
usually more than twice as much, as the in-state students. On the other hand, as state institutions funded in large part through the political process of the state, they have to be politically sensitive to the state legislatures. And the state legislatures do not like pumping money into schools that aren't educating kids from that state. And so you can see a kind of paralysis working in some of these
yes,
these colleges now.
Thanks, Mike. Best of luck to everybody in the family. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks again. Your guest said something about Harvard that really interested me because it's my impression of how things have changed among achieving students in the last, I don't know how long. But he said that kids at Harvard learn to do what's expected of them and gain approval. And my impression is that these high-achieving kids, that's more their focus now, and they're not so much. What seems like when I was younger and I went to college for the first time, people were more interested, and I went to a good school, people were more interested in just doing what they were interested in and voicing their opinions. And now I feel like kids are just doing what they need to get approval, and they don't really have their own opinions so much. And do you think that's true?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. As I said earlier, you know, there's this sense in which childhood has kind of become professionalized, in which it's a sort of a big racket in which you go and get your ticket punched here and there and there. Okay, I built the handicapped ramps at the clinic in Honduras, and I captained my lacrosse team, and I blah 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 blah, and all the way down, rather than just being kids, you know, and taking advantage of this wonderful opportunity that is being given them, that has been given really to very few generations in the history of the world, but we managed to turn it into a kind of almost like a laboratory experiment where you have to, you know, press the pellet and get the little piece of food and press the pellet again, and it's really can be quite discouraging.
I was interested in the fact, because I did this too to help pay for school. It was a great job, and that was being a lifeguard, which your son did as well.
Right.
And I thought of Ronald Reagan and his son, who wrote the book about his father, saying that he considered it very formative in his father's life, that it was an incredibly important job and very important to who Ronald Reagan was. And you guys are thinking, maybe this isn't good enough to be a lifeguard?
Right.
What?
Well, right. This is what we picked up from some of the counselors. My son had been a lifeguard for several years, and they said, "Well, this is sort of the last refuge of the slacker." You know, the kid ought to be out starting his own business, or getting an internship at a think tank or something like that. Another thing I noticed about this, as I talk about in the book, in at least out here in the East Coast, most of the public and private swimming pools are staffed by people from Eastern Europe, kids from Eastern Europe who've come over. And the reason is there is a lifeguard shortage of native-born lifeguards in America because they're all off doing these professionalized things, building their brag sheets and their resumes.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Thanks, Sarah, very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Andrew Ferguson. He's author of Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. And he now has a second child who will be going to college next year. To your phone call and more emails if you want to send one of those. Did I give you that again? It's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, Andrew, we haven't yet talked about the SATs or the ACTs. Why do students have to take these? What do they measure? And how did you do on your math?
Well, you know, you were exactly right, Kathleen. I ain't telling.
I know, I thought.
I did actually take the SAT, which is what was given out here more often than the ACT, and I did it sort of out of parental fellow feeling, I guess. I dropped my son off, early, cold Saturday morning with all his other kids hiving around the front of the high school there to go in and take the test, and they all looked kind of forlorn and so on. I later realized the reason they all looked forlorn was that they knew that they couldn't text message for the next 4 hours, and this
right.
had been the first time that had happened to them since fifth grade, I guess. But anyway, so I went home, and I got down one of these practice tests of the SAT, and I took it, and was I'm trying to think how to describe it. It turned out that large areas of my brain had turned into concrete, apparently, over the last 25 years. And there are various, as I say, I got myself into various little problems as it went along. But one thing I did notice, though, about it is that it's become an extremely boring test, which is to say that, you know, all the little squibs that you have to read and then write, answer questions about and so on are just incredibly uninteresting. And so I started to dig into the history of the SAT and the ACT, all of these standardized tests, and it's really a fascinating story. It's kind of a history of American culture in miniature over the last 80 years. But the reason that the tests are the way they are now, which is very bland and boring, is that they're so afraid of offending anyone or provoking anyone that they have just bleached every kind of provocation out of anything that appears in the test. And of course, that's a very quick way to make it boring.
Mm-hmm. And what are they supposed to measure, and how important are those grades in the results in the admissions process?
Well, this is as I say, fascinating subject that has been studied over and over again. It's unclear what faculty you would say that it's the SAT, for example, measures. It used to be called the Scholastic Aptitude Test, but they got very sheepish about that word aptitude, and so now they just call it the SAT. It's just sort of an acronym with that doesn't stand for anything. It does seem to all the evidence shows that the SAT score is a good predictor of how well a kid is going to do in the freshman year of college.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the best predictor, but it's a good predictor. So it makes it a reasonable tool for admissions people to use. It doesn't really predict how well the kid will do in sophomore, junior, and senior years in high school, and there are lots of interesting theories for why that works. It's a very contentious issue, as I go into in the book. You know, there are all sides of it. It's very emotional. It kind of takes up all of our national feelings of fairness and opportunity and, you know, individualism and all kinds of things. It's a very interesting subject.
Darlene in Kimberly. Hi. Darlene?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just quickly would like to make a couple points. I did get my degree in the 60s and 70s, right around that hump, when there was a lot of political and religious discussions and upheaval on campus that were just amazing. I went back for my second degree when I was in my 40s and graduated in 1990. At 95. And what I have noticed for the difference, of course, is there's not the time to just have these discussions. I really became aware that it was jumping through hoops. You got to do this, you got to do that. And whether you agree or not, you have to do it. And you have to persevere. If anything, it's not the intelligence of the person, it's the ability to persevere and go on and on and on and on. And as I have gotten into my work area, I have really come to believe in the statement that says, I don't care how much you know until I know how much you care.
Mm.
And I think if one thing is going to, or things that are going to help the students once they are in college, it's going to be that ability to just persevere. You have to keep going and be sure you make it real and you develop your relationships with people, because that's what's going to make the difference.
Mm. What kind of work are you in, Darlene?
Well, I'm in occupational therapy in a mental health institution.
Mm-hmm.
So I have dealt with an intake unit where I help people in crisis. I've worked with children with severe behavioral disorders. I've worked with patients who are schizophrenia. And you really do see a good cross-reference of people, you know, in stress and and going back to college at that age of 40 was challenging.
I'm sure it was. Andrew.
Well, that's a fascinating testimony. In going into why, trying to figure out why it costs so much to go to college now and to get a degree, It's another subject that has all kinds of ins and outs to it. But one of the things that kept coming up, I noticed when I talked to economists and business people and employers and so on, is they want the degree has come to mean less and less over the years because they think that colleges aren't teaching the skills that it was originally meant to. The number of employers talked to me about how the writing skills of students has gone downhill, particularly, and that a lot of the work training is actually just taking place on the job. So that when kids graduate and they have that nice sheepskin in their hand, they have to go through a whole other layer of training to even succeed in the workplace. It makes you wonder, well, what value is that sheepskin going to be if all you have to do well at a job is get trained on the job? Then it starts to make college look totally superfluous.
Thank you, Darlene, very much for your call. Dale in Black River Falls. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
All right, Dale. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Thank you. Appreciate taking my call. I have a comment that goes back to your first concerns about your son leaving home. I believe it was your final son leaving home.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And one of the things that my wife and I did when we raised our daughters is that we told them early on that our job as parents was to teach them to leave us.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that training was going to be to learn to accept and deal with failure. And by putting them in positions where if they would fail, and obviously with a smaller child you'd start on small things, but if they would fail, they could get back up and continue going and learn something from it. It made that transition for them from high school to college, and both of them graduated from University at Madison, much easier to do, but it also made it much easier for us as parents to know that when we put them out in this big bad world, they were going to be able to survive. So I guess I just wanted to make that comment as maybe something that may be helpful to some of your other listeners.
Well, it certainly is helpful to me. I mean, your kids are very lucky. I have to say they have great parents. I've thought myself, you know, I spend the last part of the book talking about this possibility of, you know, seeing your son or your daughter go off. And it's not just being, you know, empty nesters anymore. As you point out, part of it is, you know, are they going to succeed? Have I done a good enough job when they walk out the door, and as you mentioned, you know, never really do come back in a certain sense, are they well enough equipped to take all the knocks that are invariably going to come to them? And I think that this is a perfect bit of advice for parents, is let the kids know that they're going to fail once in a while.
Mm. Thanks, Dale. Jenny in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for the show today. My question to you, Andrew, is, you know, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier in the conversation, but why do we accept the situation of spending the kind of money, you know, colleges, a small liberal arts college is $35,000, $40,000 a year. Even if you go to a Big Ten school, you're talking about $10,000 to $15,000 a year. So if you go to graduate school, you know, that's a lot of money, and a lot of people go into debt for this. Why do we accept a system that takes our kids, puts us in a tremendous amount of stress and debt, and at the end, we don't even know what we got? And I'm telling you this as a person who trained as an attorney. I went to a lot of school, and I just refuse to believe that the system that people are saying, you know, you have to submit to all this testing, you have to submit to all of these getting your card punched, you know, rather than doing things for your own set of genuine reasons, you then, you know, go through all this, quote, education, but then you come out and you don't even know what you did. It has no reality. It has no attachment to your own goals and your own objectives. So why are we educating our kids this way?
Well, that is a question, Andrew.
Yeah, well, that's what the book is about, really. You know, as I say, when I really tried to get down into this, you know, why doesn't this whole industry collapse from its own failures to deliver on its core missions? And you know, as I say, the answer was staring at me in the mirror, and I would go to, you know, barbecues and stuff and other cocktail parties with parents and so on. And, you know, they were all in the same boat. The reason why this is insanity goes on was right there on the back deck eating hamburgers with me. You know, it was just part of, it's almost as though it's built into American life at a certain level. I did finally find one fellow, as I talked about in the book, a very brave economist who has studied the issue of why college costs so much so thoroughly and so honestly that every college president in America hates him. And when I put this question to him, I said, why do they keep raising their prices? He said, well, you want my short answer? It's because they can. You're not going to stop them. The federal government's not going to stop them. If anything, the federal government will try and make it easier for you to go into debt so that you can pay these exorbitant fees. And as long as everybody is buying into the system, it's going to continue.
Andrew, thank you so much for writing the book and for your good humor and advice.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and wonderful calls.
Aren't they? We have a really good audience.
Just wonderful.
Oh, great. Thanks for telling them that. That's good to hear. Once again, Andrew Ferguson, the book is Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. He's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard and author of Fools' Names, Fools' Places, a collection of essays. He's also the author of Land of Lincoln. The Wall Street Journal and the Chicago Tribune named that a favorite book of the year. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you again Monday, starting off the week with all things political. Great conversations ahead.